Welcome, everyone. I'm Erin Schaefer. I'm the Grad Assistant over at the Women's Center. I'd like to welcome you to our Women on Wednesday series, Education, Advocacy, and Empowerment, celebrating 20 years. A few items before we get started. Please turn off cell phones and pagers, and please remain in your seat until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speakers. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheets, we use this for future programming. A few items before we get started, too. There's a couple upcoming events, and one is the Mentors in Violent Prevention National Program is holding some sessions to train the trainer on how to prevent forms of violence, of men's violence against women. And if you'd like more information about that, we have some sheets in the back, so check that out afterwards. Also, Daisy Hernandez is speaking tonight at 6 o'clock to 7:30 over at Ritchie Auditorium. And she is a feminist author, journalist, and editor of Color Lines magazines. I think we also have postcards in the back. All right. Today our session is titled, Do Women Deserve Human Rights? Revitalizing CEDAW in the U.S. And it is in commemoration of International Women's Day, which is March 8th. Today's talk will discuss CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which has been signed by the vast majority of countries, but not by the United States. Our panelists will discuss why the U.S. won't sign a treaty that supports the human rights of women, what's at stake, and what can be done about it. Our panelists today are Dr. Linda Butenhoff, Dr. Mumbi Mwangi, and Dr. Emily Schultz. Dr. Linda Butenhoff is a professor of political science and director of the Center for Global Studies and Global Studies Program at SJSU. She holds a doctorate in international studies. Dr. Mumbi Mwangi is an assistant professor and in the SJSU Women's Studies Program. She holds a PhD in education and a minor in women's studies. Dr. Emily Schultz is a cultural anthropologist, author, and professor in the SJSU Anthropology Department. We are very grateful to have them here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Dr. Linda Butenhoff, Dr. Mumbi Mwangi, and Dr. Emily Schultz.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? I can't tell. Closer? Okay. How about that? Oh, yeah, all right. Very good. Thank you. I'm going to be speaking first about some general issues having to do with human rights and women's rights from the point of view of anthropology, and then the specifics of CEDAW will be addressed by my colleagues on the panel. So, if I can make this work. First, I thought I'd give just a brief introduction for those who might not know what CEDAW is. It stands for the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And this little excerpt here is from the website, the UN website about CEDAW. I just wanted to highlight some of the key features. According to the website, it was adopted in 1979 by the UN General Assembly and is often described as an international bill of rights for women. And the convention defines discrimination against women as, quote, any distinction, exclusion, or restriction made on the basis of sex, which has the effect or purpose of impairing or nullifying the recognition, enjoyment, or exercise by women, irrespective of their marital status, on a basis of equality of men and women, of human rights and fundamental freedoms in the political, economic, social, cultural, civil, or any other field, unquote. By accepting the convention, states commit themselves to undertake a series of measures to end discrimination against all women in all forms. And this latter part is very important, that states are responsible for implementing the convention, not the UN itself. These are four topics that I want to touch on briefly today. First, how anthropologists study human rights issues. Secondly, I want to briefly introduce two major arguments anthropologists have identified that concern the way human rights and culture are related. Third, I want to talk a bit about how human rights law itself can be studied as a form of culture. And finally, I want to speak briefly about anthropological research on women's rights as human rights. I'll mention CEDAW, but also other examples from anthropological research. I think we can begin with sort of a rough and ready working definition of what human rights are. Powers, privileges, or material resources to which people everywhere are justly entitled by virtue of being human. Now, discourses about human rights have proliferated in recent decades. In multicultural settings, in a globalized world, different cultural understandings of what it means to be human and what human rights are becomes the focus of contention. Now, ever since the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights in 1948 and followed by other declarations, discussion about human rights has spread everywhere. Work by the UN and non-government organizations throughout the world has spread the discourse of human rights. And this quotation is from some anthropologists who've worked in human rights on human rights issues in a number of settings. Quote, "It's no use imagining a primitive tribe which has not yet heard of human rights. What it means to be indigenous is itself transformed through interaction with human rights discourses and institutions." So everybody knows about human rights everywhere. Anthropologists are paying attention to the discourse of human rights in the varied settings where they do their research. Anthropologist Sally Ingle Mary, who is a legal anthropologist, has written that an emerging culture of human rights has become the preeminent global language of social justice. Now, to talk about human rights is not straightforward, however. Two major arguments about the way human rights and culture are related are as follows. I'll deal with them one by one. First, that human rights are opposed to culture, and secondly, that a key universal right is precisely one's right to culture. These would seem somewhat contradictory, and again, anthropologists have talked about this. Let's look at the first to begin with, that the idea that human rights might be opposed to culture. Such arguments depend on two assumptions. First, that cultures, and I would put quotation marks around that, are homogeneous, bounded, and unchanging sets of ideas and practices, and second, that each society has only one culture which its members are obligated to follow. These assumptions are severely criticized by cultural anthropologists and others, but such a view of culture is very much alive in many human rights disputes. If people have no choice but to follow the rules of the one culture into which they were born, international interference with customs said to violate human rights would itself constitute a human rights violation. Thus, culture should be allowed to enjoy absolute, inviolable protection from interference by outsiders. This has been the position adopted by some national governments that have refused to sign the CEDAW Declaration that violence against women violates human rights. Mary writes, "Many states have opposed this conception of human rights on cultural or religious grounds and have refused to ratify treaties which they see as unwelcome neo-colonial impositions." But there are some responses that we can make to this view of human rights and culture. First, cultural values cannot be held responsible for everything that people do in any society. Although some forms of violence against women may be culturally sanctioned in some societies, violence against women can take many forms, even in those societies, and not all of these are accorded the same degree of cultural support. Second, being forced to choose between rights or culture seems unviable. Many anthropologists and others are convinced that the rights versus culture debate exaggerates cultural differences. Today, most cultural anthropologists think of culture as a field of creative interchange and contestation, not as a homogeneous, bounded, and unchanging set of ideas and practices. Finally, it sometimes looks as if culture is being used as a scapegoat. For example, in the 1990s, Indonesia and Singapore positioned themselves as stout defenders of, quote, Asian values, unquote. But they are among the states in the world who have welcomed Western industrial capitalism with greatest success. So for some people, to reject human rights discourse because it contradicts Asian values suggests at the very least an inconsistent attitude toward Westernization. Observers wonder if the defense of Asian values might be a political tactic designed to bolster state sovereignty and resist international denunciations of internal repression and political dissent. Now let's look at the second argument here, the notion that all peoples have a universal human right to maintain their own distinct cultures. The right to culture has already been explicit in a number of international rights documents. This argument seems to concede that there are such things as universal human rights, and the list must now include the right to one's own culture. Cultural diversity is understood as intrinsically valuable, and people should be able to observe their own cultural practices free from outside interference. However, this argument calls into question the common understanding that people frequently have that to be freed from the constraints of local cultures is how you get to enjoy your full human rights. Okay, so a right to culture is a new one, and it's a challengeable one, has been challenged, and therefore it requires legal mechanisms to ensure protection. However, human rights are legally interpreted as individual rights, not group rights. and people must demand the governments of their nation states of which they are citizens to recognize and enforce individual rights. And the same would apply to group rights, and certainly applies also to CEDAW. Now, the UN might use its persuasive power to urge such changes, but it has no coercive power to force any nation state into compliance with its declarations. Now, it's true the Right to Culture movement has succeeded in recent years in eroding the traditionally recognized right of nation states to determine the kinds of rights their citizens will be accorded. But, again, the Right to Culture argument can also be called upon to legitimate reactionary projects as easily as progressive ones. And the anthropologists who've studied this issue would agree that the uses to which culture can be put in relation to rights are evidently multiple. So, let's go on then. Anthropologists have addressed the ways in which human rights discourse can itself be seen as a form of culture, and I want to talk briefly about that. The tools that anthropologists have developed to study cultural patterns are well suited to investigate the extent to which a culture of human rights has now emerged. This culture of human rights is based on ideas about human beings, their needs, and their ability to exercise agency, as well as the kinds of social connections between human beings that are considered illegitimate and legitimate. The question of legitimacy in human rights discourse points to the central role of law, once again, both as a way of articulating certain human rights and as a tool for defending those rights. Legal anthropologists point out that talk about a culture of human rights originated in Western legal and secular discourse. It focused on the rights of individuals, it proposed to relieve human suffering through technical rather than ethical solutions, and it emphasizes rights over duties or needs. And so the question becomes, can this culture of human rights be legitimately extended across cultural boundaries where these ideas about human nature and human rights are not found? Secondly, anthropological struggles with the concept of culture allow anthropologists to mount a critique of some of the ways that the concept of culture has been mobilized in the discussion of human rights. To use the culture concept means looking for patterns and relationships of meaning and practice between different domains of social life. Human rights are articulated in legal documents. One of the most important patterns that becomes visible in the culture of human rights is the way in which rights accommodate the law. To get the courts to take claims of human rights violations seriously, it's important to understand how the law operates and what kinds of claims the law pays attention to. For example, only certain kinds of claims are usually admissible. For example, the law is best suited to redress the grievances of individuals, not groups. The law is best suited to provide technical rather than ethical remedies. And the law emphasizes rights over duties and needs, as we saw. So plaintiffs are likely to have a difficult time if they want to claim that their group rights have been violated, or that they want the violator exposed and punished, or that the state itself has failed to fulfill its responsibilities. A claim to human rights, therefore, involves learning how to craft cases that will fit the laws. This can be tricky if the categories and identities recognized in human rights law do not correspond to categories and identities that are meaningful to the plaintiffs. Now I'd like to turn to the work of one legal anthropologist who specialized in issues of gender and human rights. Sally Engle-Mary has studied a feminist program in Hilo, Hawaii that attempts to support women victims of violence and retrain male batterers. This domestic abuse program was based on one that originally was developed in Duluth, and it works closely with the courts. And so you can see in 1985 the courts adopted the language of rights in dealing with violence against women. This means that the law supports the notion of gender equality, and when husbands are found guilty of battering their wives, the couple is supposed to be separated. But this is a problem because many of the Hawaiian couples who participate in the program are often conservative Christians who do not believe in divorce. So this would seem to create some friction. And this would seem to be a classic conflict between rights and culture. But in fact, Mary writes, local adaptations of the rights model do take place. This was done by tailoring the program's curriculum to local circumstances by using Hawaiian images and examples. Particularly interesting was the way that part of the program designed to teach anger management to batterers was made locally relevant by combining Christian ideas with ideas from Hawaiian activists that connected male anger to the losses they have suffered as a consequence of conquest. Mary visited a similar kind of program in New Zealand based on the same Minnesota model that had been locally modified for Maori men in a way that linked their anger to Maori experiences of racism and loss. Mary writes, although these programs share a similar commitment to a rights-based approach that works in conjunction with the local criminal justice system, each has developed a local accommodation of the curriculum, a reframing which takes into account local problems and cultural practices. In Mary's estimation, change does not come overnight, but in fits and starts. It took 32 years for traditional Hawaiian law to be transformed into Christianized Hawaiian law between 1820 and 1844, and then to achieve the adoption of a secularized Western law between 1845 and 1852. This process involved colonial imposition, but also active collaboration by Hawaiian elites. She describes the process as a process of transculturation, in which subjugated Hawaiians received and adopted forms of self-understanding imposed by the Christian West, even as the Christian West was modified in response. After 30 years, perhaps the implementation of CEDAW may be on a similar trajectory. It's signed but not implemented entirely, or not signed but implemented in part. It has had a very varied career, and we'll learn more about that shortly. Progress is not uniform everywhere, but perhaps some progress is going on in many places. And I would simply end by saying that transculturation is hard work, and people should keep pressing. Thank you.
I want to stand.
Okay.
So I'm going to walk over this other side.
Well, I'm going to focus just really on CEDAW.
Could you please use a microphone?
I'll try.
Okay.
I talk with my hands.
Okay.
So it may be going in and out, but I'll do my best here. So I'm going to focus on CEDAW itself, and in particular efforts in the United States to ratify the document. I titled this The U.S. and CEDAW, A Long and Winding Road to Ratification. Some of you may get the reference to the Beatles here. I first wanted to start off with just the treaty process. Some of you may be unfamiliar with how treaties, conventions are actually formulated. So I just put a few points here. To draw our attention to, it is done today through the United Nations process. Generally within the General Assembly, there's a legal committee that drafts, this is for any convention, any treaty, that will draft language. Interested states, state parties is what they call them, will get together and work on that language. Generally, these are experts in that particular field that will work on that language. Once the language of the treaty is complete, it will then be open for signing and then ratification. Some countries have sort of an automatic process. If the head of the government signs it, it may be automatically ratified. And other countries, like the United States, our executive, our president, signs it, but we also have a check or a balance on that process in that the Senate must ratify the document. And then it actually has to go back to the president for signature. So there's sort of a multiple process here. And then, of course, with most treaties, there's a reporting process that goes along with it. So countries have to submit reports or testify on what they're doing in regards to the treaty itself. So CEDAW, the treaty process here, it actually started in 1946 when the United Nations established the Commission on the Status of Women, who then set out to draft the language of the convention. This took some 3 decades to do this, as Emily mentioned. So it opened for ratification December 18th, 1979, when the General Assembly adopted the convention. And then other states could sign it and ratified it. It entered into what international legal people call force. That is, enough states have now ratified it as of September 3rd, 1981, for it to be considered part of international law. Today, 186 states have ratified the convention. There are like 7 states that have not. The United States is the only advanced country and the only democracy that has yet to ratify the document. So we are in the company of Sudan, Somalia, and Iran. Some have asked, why do we need CEDAW, especially in the United States? Don't we have the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and plenty of laws? Why do we need it? Why do women around the world need it? So I thought I would put down some statistics, sir, about the status of women around the world. Violence against women. 1 in 3 women will experience assault, rape, or other abuse during her lifetime. 2/3 of the world's 771 million illiterate adults are women. I always like to throw in here, Amartya Sen, who is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, said no state will ever develop unless women are equally educated with men. Of the 1.3 billion poorest people, 70% are women. Millions of women and girls are denied equal access to property, legal action, civic life, and public participation. Lack of adequate health care means that more than 530,000 women die each year from pregnancy-related complications. That's about one every minute. Just last week, you know, here in the United States, we're discussing health care reform. The BBC did a comparison between U.S., France, Singapore, and the U.S. The United States had the largest pregnancy-related deaths of those four countries. Around 80%, you know, currently human trafficking is kind of a big topic, contemporary modern-day slavery. Of the, I would put this almost a million victims of human trafficking, 80% of them are girls under the age of 18. For information, I did put the source of this information in the PowerPoint here. There's a link. I also have the definition here from CEDAW about discrimination. And again, I have a link here for the complete text of CEDAW. Like most international treaties, it's lengthy. It says here, any distinction, exclusion, or restriction made on the basis of sex, which has the effect or purpose of impairing or nullifying the recognition, enjoyment, or exercise of women, irrespective of their marital status, on the basis of equality of men and women, of human rights and fundamental freedoms in the political, economic, social, cultural, or any other field. And so what I've done here, I've sort of generalized the six parts of the convention, of the treaty. So part one deals with the general principles and commitments. Here, it really is a statement that all forms of discrimination are to be eliminated within states. Part two does focus on political and civil rights of women. That is, where states have, well, all states are supposed to encourage political and civil participation of men and women. And where it's restricted to women, those laws, those obstacles are supposed to be removed. That is, the state is to take steps to eliminate and remove those barriers. Part three relates to social areas. This is a little bit unique here, I think, in that in CEDAW, in this section, they do focus on women in rural areas because oftentimes those are the poorest and the most without resources. Part four is have in place legal and judicial procedures to protect the rights of women. Again, if you are guaranteed rights, both in political, civil, and social economic arenas, there should be a mechanism by which women can pursue complaints that they have been denied them or discriminated. Part four is that this is, again, CEDAW wants states that have signed and ratified the document to submit a report about every 4 years to what's known as the Committee for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And this is a committee that's made up of about 23 experts in the field who review these documents and then provide suggestions as to what the state can do to better the situation, the lives of women in their country. Part six here is implementation and dispute resolution issues. Obviously, like with most things, there's going to be misunderstandings in the convention itself, what the various language means. So there's mechanisms within the treaty to deal with that. This is also the place where it states that reservations may be allowed. And what that means is that each state that wants to sign and ratify it may attach conditions to particular articles of the convention. They're sometimes known as reservations, declarations, and understandings. So here I have a rationale for why the U.S. should ratify CEDAW. It's argued that it would give the U.S. more leverage and credibility regarding women's rights. Without it, the U.S. has no official standing in the international community when it comes to women's rights. We are not part of this international legal process. The U.S. failure to ratify, it appears as if we are indifferent to women's rights. It's also argued that if the U.S. signed this document, it could use it as a foreign policy tool. right, the U.S. could put pressure on states, especially if the majority of the states in the international community have signed and ratified it and the U.S. hasn't, it really calls into the question the leadership of the United States on this particular human rights issue as well. Ratification, again, here would give U.S. membership in that committee that I was talking about that reviews these reports submitted by countries. The U.S. really does have a bipartisan history about signing international human rights documents. And some have wondered why this one has taken so long for the U.S. to ratify it. We have signed and ratified the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. We still haven't ratified the International Covenant on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights. Maybe that's the other one that's a long and winding road. Status of U.S. women could use improvement. Here at the 2008 World Economic Forum, Gender Gap Report places the U.S. 31st in overall gender equity and 69th in proportion of women in Congress or in legislatures. So we still have some improvement to do. The U.S. ratification process, and I was referring to this earlier, and so I don't know if I necessarily need to spend time on it. It's a bit of a civics lesson here, but the process starts with the president signing the document and then sending it to the Senate. In the Senate, of course, it goes to the U.S. Foreign Relations Committee, which deliberates the treaty. Oftentimes, the Department of State, through the Secretary of State, will do an analysis of the treaty and then provide its recommendation, and if there are any reservations, declaration, or understandings that should go along with it. They will submit that often when there are hearings and requests for information on the treaty. If it passes the U.S. Foreign Relations Committee, if it gets out of committee, it will then go to a floor for a vote on the floor. And then once if it passes there, and I think it needs a two-thirds majority vote for that, it will then go back to the president who signs it, and the ratification process is complete. The ratification in the U.S. and its effect on U.S. law. It's argued that this treaty is non-self-executing, and what that means is that it does not authorize any action not already allowed under U.S. law. I do have a link here to the National Organization of Women have done, as of this last summer, a really thorough analysis of the expected reservations that the U.S. is expected to place on the treaty. Yeah, it's interesting. I was unable to find the Obama administration or Secretary of State Clinton putting out any draft reservations yet or any real comments other than they want it passed or ratified. But if we have time, maybe later on I can talk about some of these specific reservations. There are 11 of them, and it's lengthy. So. And kind of dense in many ways. The UN has no enforcement authority. CEDAW commits states to report. Right? CEDAW committee also is comprised here of 23 experts who review and report and offer ways to better women's lives. The opposition. So if this is such a good thing, and the U.S., of course, recognizes women's rights, why haven't we ratified it already? So I put together some of the most prominent arguments as to why the U.S. should not ratify it. The opposition argues that it will negate family law and undermine traditional family values by redefining the family. It also argues that requires countries to enact quotas for elected positions in private businesses. That's in terms of having equality, right? Ensures access to abortion services and contraception, allows same-sex marriage, will legalize or decriminalize prostitution, promote gender re-education, negate parental rights, and undermine the sovereignty of the United States. So, will the U.S. ratify CEDAW? I put the Obama administration, of course, this has gone through quite a few administrations. The Carter administration was the administration that first signed the treaty and sent it to the Senate. And then, of course, it went through President Reagan. At that time, Senator Helms chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he said it would remain permanently filed for a long time. It sort of did get out of committee but discussed in committee. It was never sent to a floor vote. During the Clinton administration, it actually did get out of committee. They did pass to send it to the floor, but then they never were able to discuss it, and it just sort of lingered. That was, I think, the closest they got to a Senate floor vote was like 2002 or so. So here, you know, the Obama administration has stated that they are committed to the ratification of CEDAW. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said that she is committed to the ratification of CEDAW. Even the UN Ambassador Rice has said that they are committed to the ratification of CEDAW. Players in the U.S. Senate here, of course, we have Senator John Kerry is the current chair of the U.S. Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Barbara Boxer of California is also a longstanding proponent of ratification of CEDAW. And I thought I would end by asking this question that maybe we can take up during the question time of what can we do. I will put this forward, is that there are a number of states in the United States that have signed and ratified it themselves. So they are going beyond, right, or outside of the federal system and doing it locally. Even some cities, counties, and states have done this.
Hello. Okay. Thank you very much. My portion really is going to focus more on the implication of CEDAW on women in third world countries and in Africa. So again, if I take the basic title, do women deserve human rights or do third world women deserve human rights? And of course they do. And, you know, what also it means apparently is that in a situation where the U.S. has not ratified the CEDAW, it also has implication for women, and especially in third world countries, and especially when they look at up to the U.S. As a kind of guiding light. You know, how does the U.S. apparently claim to have women issues at heart when they have not necessarily ratified this kind of convention? And what is the implication of the U.S. stand on other women, especially marginalized women in the world? So what I'm going to focus very, very briefly, I don't think I have a lot of time, is maybe just highlight the fact that CEDAW has done some work or has actually improved some of the status of women, especially as far as human rights is concerned. And, you know, if I had time, I would actually literally go and talk about, you know, various kind of countries. Many governments, for example, in Africa and other third world countries, of course, have taken the issues that CEDAW has put across in terms of incorporating women in development or in positions of power. But again, the number is very, very minimal. Now, in my country, Kenya, I know that the government has ratified the convention. However, we still see a lot of obstacles for women. One of the things that I know that the Kenyan government has done, of course, is to introduce the Women's Bureau. And Women's Bureau is actually under the Ministry of, I think, Sports and I don't know what else, Sports, you know, that's where, sorry? Sports and Gender Affairs, and that's where the Women's Bureau is supposed to be. You know, that tells you, of course, you know, in terms of how much the importance that government puts on it. Now, when you think about also the improvement of the political arena, especially in Kenya too, we have seen a number of women actually going into politics, but still, it's just a very, very small percentage. What I think about, of course, is that it's one thing actually to have a convention like this one ratified. It's a totally different thing to actually implement it. So even as we celebrate, of course, that, you know, our countries and most of the third world countries have ratified, we still are very wary of the implication of that, or even what has come out of that in terms of the improvement of women's issues. Now, I know Emily talked about the idea of the fact that most of the human rights, suggestions, of course, also are, again, in some of the culture. And I think that is very true, too, because most of the time when you think about human rights, you're also kind of thinking about, you know, intruding in people's culture. And that has been one of the problems. CEDAW might have all these, articles in the convention. But what is interesting also is how is that one also, affecting women, for example, in cultures where, again, they hold a very, very lower position. Now, I'm talking about the fact that, you know, most of the cultures are patriarchal cultures. Now, how does CEDAW, for example, deal with the situation where, you know, some of the things that they have advocated, of course, is seen as against the culture, and still women are subordinated within those cultures. So one of the issues, of course, is in terms of how CEDAW has impacted women in third world countries is the debate between what we call, we can actually call it cultural relativism and cultural, what I call universalism. CEDAW may have actually thought about the fact that even when we have all these conventions, we are assuming that this is the way to go. This is a cultural, universal kind of culture. But think about maybe the different kinds of cultures in Africa, for example, my country, and the fact that you cannot necessarily just identify one culture. So what happens to those cultures that still dominate women and where we think about patriarchy in different levels of subordination? Now, I'm thinking about the issues of the position of women in different countries, and especially the fact that most of women are actually living in rural areas. What happens, for example, when we have all these conventions well articulated, but how much are they relevant to the lives and everyday lives of women in Africa? I'm talking about rural women in Africa. One of the things that the CEDAW has, of course, talked about is that everybody should have access to education, that everybody should have access to legal information, that they should be able to know what is happening in their lives. Now, when I think about rural women in Africa, for example, most of those things are not necessarily something that they can be able to access. Now, what I can actually comfortably say is that even when we have all these things very well written, most of them have not had an impact on lives of women. I'm thinking about rural women in the sense that sometimes, you know, they actually have the brunt of everything else. We are talking about globalization today and the world debt. The impact of globalization and the impact of the debt in third world countries is actually very much experienced by women in rural Africa and rural, third world countries. You know, how much has CEDAW's convention, for example, or articles reflected on the consequences of globalization? The other thing also is the impact of violence against women. We have seen a lot of violence in most of the war-torn zones in Africa and other parts of the world. Somalia, of course, has not, ratified, but still we are seeing apparently that there's a lot of violence against women, even in the areas that have ratified some of these, some of the convention. Now, Rwanda, for example, we watched genocide in Rwanda, and we never, even this, the U.S. never even wanted to help one bit. Right now, Rwanda is reeling out of the genocide. The majority of people who are actually looking for peace right now and negotiating peace are women. You know, I don't think we can actually, you know, just ignore the role of women, especially in peacekeeping and all that. But where is CEDAW? You know, how have we seen actually CEDAW implement some of this, whatever, or even pressurize, for example, other governments and even those who have actually signed the convention to look at the specific areas of women, especially women in rural area. Now, the other thing also that I just want to mention, of course, is the issue of HIV epidemic. You know, we are talking about access to, human rights. Now, it's amazing, apparently, that it's only now that the world is beginning to see HIV/AIDS as a human rights thing. You know, we are comfortable thinking about HIV/AIDS as just a disease. This morning I was reading somewhere that it's a kind of a black disease. And when we put those kind of labels on some of these things, then we fail to see, of course, the devastation of HIV/AIDS in rural Africa. The majority of people who are being infected, of course, are women. And most of them, women are also in rural areas. So it's one thing, apparently, to think about this and to bring into the light rights, the context within which women actually function in everyday lives, and especially those women who are not necessarily always seen. We can talk all we want about the ratification and the consequences of that, but I think we also have to think about the fact that we are dealing with issues that pertain to women in their everyday lives. It's about human rights, it's about life and death. Again, when you think about, maybe reasons why, for example, U.S. has not ratified this particular convention, we can see, of course, that sometimes we have to think about what are those things that are priority to us. And, of course, we also know that sometimes we don't think about prioritizing things that are not necessarily directly involved with us or those things that touch us, in every aspect of our lives. But at the same time, also the idea here is how are we going to be able to bring other people's experiences, and especially those who don't actually appear like they are very important to us, to bring about these issues. So as I think I'm going to stop there. We are almost done. But what I want to think about, to reiterate here, of course, is that CEDAW has done quite a bit of it, but I think it lacks the mechanism actually to reach out to women, for example, in third world countries who really need the convention to move them out of their poverty and out of their subordination and also out of their exploitation from a global perspective. I don't think CEDAW has really gotten that message across. The other thing also is that I don't think CEDAW has found a way of reconnecting with the women who actually need all the kind of tools that they need and the language that they need. Linda was talking about the language of convention. I wonder how many times we have actually decided to actually go and talk to the people who really need this kind of thing so that we can be able to incorporate their language into some of these things. This is also very, very artificial. This is up there, very aloof. We need to find a way of that we can be able to incorporate the sides and also the experiences and the language of people who need the services, and services, especially those ones of CEDAW. Thank you very much. I think that's exactly what we need to do. How many times do we have, for example, situations where we have problems, and especially when we are thinking about the perception of U.S. and Western world to other world, for example, third world countries, we tend to go there with a solution already. Everything laid out. We have already defined the problem. And then we tell them this is what we need to do. I think we have to change that. We are talking about a global village today. We cannot afford to imagine that we have solutions and we have the language to express those solutions anymore. We have to go to those people, and especially the people who need the services that we think we have, to ask them, what exactly do you think we put here? What is your language? What do you want expressed? I was talking to my students the other day and said, one of them asked me, do you think in your mother tongue or do you think in English? And so I say, I have no idea. Maybe I think in my mother tongue. And then translating what I'm thinking and turning it into English is a totally difficult kind of process. And my brain is working throughout doing that. Because my language and English, for example, don't even have, if I have to translate directly from my language, it will not make sense. The same kind of thing. Ask them, let them express what they need, and then we can be able to incorporate that. I think the idea also of translating the language and the convention treaty to different languages is important. That is how we bring the concept of inclusiveness.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. And then maybe.
Assuming that CEDAW has promise and potential, whether in the U.S. or globally, what can we do? And part of it, it reminds me of the strong opposition to the U.S. passing an Equal Rights Amendment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there's tons of power and potential behind CEDAW and an ERA, but we're not moving. So what can we do to move it forward and then to move it maybe in new realms in which it would be more helpful and relevant to women globally? That's a big question that any of you could speak to.
Well, the one response I would offer would be Sally Engle Mary's response, is that it's a long process, and she herself has looked at cases where people seemingly at an impasse have nevertheless been able to find an alternate route or find some way of reconfigurating or tailoring certain aspects of a legal, of a law or of some principle in terms that are meant that are understandable to people locally. And of course they have input in making that. It involves translation and dialogue across these boundaries, and it's not without friction, but you can make progress. And I think the example that she gave of the domestic abuse program is evidence of what can be done. I mean, that's just a tiny little thing, but it is hard work, and it does, and it's not going to succeed unless you have folks on both sides who are trying to find some way around the impasse, I think.
Well, I guess I would argue is that one of the things we need to do is to really incorporate it into education from preschool probably up. There is, for instance, in the general human rights approach to promoting universal human rights, whether civil and political or cultural or economic, the UN, a little bit here in the United States, approach has been to distribute, for instance, the declaration, the UDHR. It has a little pamphlet in multiple languages everywhere. On the United Nations website, for instance, they have human rights education. I know the United Nations Association throughout the United States and throughout the world has, it's called Cyber School Bus, and they have classroom, global classroom programs in which they're trying to, you know, sort of disseminate general information about human rights. I think a similar approach to understanding women's issues and women's rights need to be started very early on and just part of the ordinary curriculum, so that people, as we grow up, because I don't know the students here, how much you really know about women's rights, not just the claim women have rights, but what is the actual situation of women in the United States, in the developing world, in various places where have so many multicultural aspects to women. We were having lunch last week and talking about the situation in France, in which the hijab is prohibited in schools, in public places. In a recent parliamentary report, has recommended the banning of veiling in schools, at work, and in public transportation. So, and they have a very different cultural and different experience and citizenship, but we don't even know about those things in the United States, and it's such a fundamental education issue for me. One of the most significant experiences I had was as I was finishing my graduate degree, I participated in a seminar at the University of Arizona in Tucson. It's the Southwest Institute for Research on Women, and one of the things they were trying to do was to bring in people like me who don't specialize in gender issues to really think about gender as a mainstream, ordinary aspect to every course that you teach. It's just integrated into the curriculum everywhere. And that's something I've tried to do in virtually every class that I teach. I have not just a component on women and gender, but the understanding, the gendered analysis and gendered lens and gendered thinking, and virtually everything that I teach in the classroom is incorporated. So hopefully my students may not realize it, but they're getting a little bit of it. But that's because I think just the ratification is one thing, but it has to...
Yeah, I think for me, again, I would just focus on the idea that we have to be realistic about where we want to go. And I don't think we have articulated that so far. CEDA has been there for more than 30 years. We need to do something different, you know, because whatever we have been doing is not working. So we have to actually decide and develop a new perspective. Including gender is a big thing, and especially it's not just gender, but gender in different parts of the world, and the concept of diversity and globalization as well.